Hello and welcome to The Future of Shopping, a new Vogue Business podcast that investigates what the new era of shopping will look like, presented by Worldpay. Fashion retail has reached a tipping point, facing into a future in which social commerce and the algorithm's influence are growing, and people's values are changing. For the next 8 weeks, our editors will be diving into what the new era of shopping will look like. We'll unpack what comes next for e-commerce, social commerce, and Web3, what will happen to malls and high streets, and how consumers will shop in the future. Hello, and welcome to this episode of Vogue Business's The Future of Shopping. We're your co-hosts, Maliha Shoaib
and Rachel Czernamski.
Consumer behavior is at a really peculiar point right now. On one hand, consumers are more likely than ever to say that they value sustainability and social justice. But at the same time, overconsumption is at high. And most consumers admit that they don't always shop their values. Now, this can be for a number of reasons, from price to convenience to a lack of sizing options, and even more broadly, a sense of disillusionment about the chaos of this consumerist world that we live in. And while consumers are confused about how to shop their values, brands are equally confused about how to communicate theirs, while also avoiding things like greenwashing or tokenism. Now, the good news is that all of this is starting to change as the fashion industry is becoming more regulated on issues like sustainability.
Today, we're going to focus on some of the big picture of how sustainability in general and a person's intent to shop their values in particular get derailed by consumerism. We'll get into why a values-driven approach appeals to specific consumer groups and best practices for how brands can communicate and appropriately market their values. To dive into the details about consumer values and behavior and the future of how they'll change, we're joined by broadcaster and advisor Kate Hardcastle, who is an expert in all things consumer behavior. In fact, she's known as the customer whisperer. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you.
So, Kate, I want to come to you first. Now, we've spoken in the past about pick and mix ethics, which is when there's a discrepancy between what consumers say and what they do. So that's why I want to begin our conversation with. Why exactly does this happen in the first place?
Well, thanks for having me. And yes, pick and mix ethics is a terminology that I coined to try and describe the very difficult pathway that consumers face when it comes to trying to make the decisions that they feel motivated to make, or they might have had recent education pieces on. And yet, actually, the here and now maybe of a retail environment, or indeed an online shopping browser, or perhaps social media push, that means that those elements perhaps aren't as important or become less informed, less detailed at the point of purchase. It's almost like if you imagine, rather than a hierarchy of needs, a hierarchy of needs. So when consumers are perhaps reading something, feeling very motivated about supply chain or the impact of fashion, those values and the need to do something about it is very much at the height of the hierarchy of needs. But actually then, as a garment appears in front of them on social media that looks fantastic at a great price point, it's available quickly, the availability and the price take over in that hierarchy of needs. And then some of those environmental question marks and some of the need to do better starts to fall down that ladder. And so it's not as simple as somebody opts for one element or another. They want something that looks good, feels great, is affordable, but they just move away from environmental ethics. It's more that there's a whole collective of considerations. And at the point of purchase, the emergency of it still impacts consumers in a way that perhaps only two or three of the things that they actually are considering come to the forefront of mind. And that's really the challenging opportunity out of how we buy, that at point of purchase, emotion overtakes.
Those are really great points. There's an intent to buy sustainably and even an attempt to buy less, that people sort of have these notions of what they want to do, but then there's all these social pressures and there's some basic fundamental needs. I've talked to a lot of behavior psychologists about, you know, what sort of drives our impulses and what sort of basic human needs with what we've come to start satisfying with fashion purchases and keeping up with trends and sense of belonging in community and various factors like that. So it's really interesting to think about it as a hierarchy versus hierarchy. I hadn't heard that term before. Then there's also the climate anxiety that we hear about, with young people being so concerned about the climate, but then it's also like it's so urgent and so desperate that then like it just feels sort of beyond hope in a way. And what can we do about it? So there's just, it's a swirling mess really that we're trying to parse out and overcome.
It's very natural for consumers to feel so overwhelmed by something that it becomes too big to manage. And that kind of reassurance of, well, what would the difference of one small action of someone like me, what would that really make? And that sometimes also becomes a reassurance in that, well, actually, if I'd have made no change at all, I'm one of millions, if not billions. So my change today isn't going to make that difference. And I think there's so much to unpick here. So I'm really glad that you're doing this podcast to try and open up some of the rationale behind it. I think we have a challenge in that a lot of information is still important for consumers to make their own. And what I mean by that is, we have a lot of discussion about potential legislation with some on the way. We have conversations from researchers, people who've been in the field like me, in the factory floors, so I understand what that looks like. Scientists who are talking particularly on the environmental element. But that is not instantly digestible information. And that means that at point of purchase, we know that price can be communicated really quickly and easily. We know the look of something can be communicated easily. But what's the flashpoint? What's the easy and instantaneous message when it comes to environmentalism at point of purchase? It's just not there. At best, there might be some kind of symbolism. And then unpicking what that symbolism means is actually a whole other minefield for the consumer too. One of my biggest frustrations is that there isn't a unity in the symbolism of what that garment's credentials means yet, and certainly not done globally, where we can just see something and say, okay, that's made of recycled materials to 90%. Oh, I can recycle that item. Oh, I know that that's gone through a certain process that is better for the environment. There's nothing on that scale. Ditto also in FMCG, which is another arena I work in. So we're expecting consumers to take almost a tome worth of information at a point of purchase, which is exciting and thrilling and very quick normally, and apply that at that point. That's really unfair. And it seems an obstacle that's too high to jump for the majority of consumers I know.
That's the exact sort of feedback that I heard from the consumers I spoke to for this story and for this podcast. To read a couple of the quotes that we got. So a 24-year-old statistical programmer, Victoria Ash, said, "I wish there was a way that you could have the information that almost makes the decision for you in terms of buying ethically." I think that kind of really speaks to how consumers are wanting this sort of like stamp of approval that shows that, okay, I can just hassle-free make my purchase and know that it's not been made under terrible conditions. And that's something that legislation will eventually lead to, but we're not quite there yet. I think that because of the lack of progress, people are now feeling this almost existential dread. And, you know, one of the other consumers I spoke to, he said, "There's no ethical consumption under capitalism, but there are some very nice coats." And, you know, I think it just really points to how people do feel that this whole system is just so broken that they have no agency. So why not buy that one nice thing to feel good in the moment? And, you know, it also doesn't help that our society really does connect our identity really around what we consume. So, you know, what trends we buy into are really closely connected to how we feel and which communities we feel part of.
60% of purchase decisions are still made at point of purchase. So whilst we know that people up to 60% can be swayed because of the look, the feel, the rush of adrenaline, the emotional requirement, the need, we're not going to be able to change behaviour that quickly if we're still reliant on the tools and techniques available to us today. So it's almost like we need to do a consumer opt-in pre-authorization. Please only authorize me to buy this if it meets these set of values that I want to buy into to start with. Because the one thing we know, and it doesn't matter whether it's sustainability, whether it's value orientation in shopping, how consumers want to shop online or offline, everything's about ease of purchase. And if it isn't easy, it just will not happen.
And there's also the point about, you know, there's been a lot of talk about that with the growth of resale and rental and the platforms that are trying to make it easier to shop that way rather than having to, you know, pour through vintage, like the racks and racks of secondhand stores or vintage shops. So I think there's something to that. But then there's also the piece of constant consumption, and there's this pressure to have a new look every day. And it used to be where you couldn't wear the same dress to two weddings or to two different events. It's now it's more like I posted in that already rather than I've worn that to a social event. Regulators are starting to write policies about, you know, how brands can operate and even what they can say about what they make. Do you see any schemes in the work for addressing that larger mechanism that is driving everyone to want a new look all the time? And the impulse purchase seems like a big part of the problem. And I don't see any regulations that address that.
So I think you've got to start at the truth of where consumerism comes from. I've been working in factories for decades, and I saw the vast warehouses of garments and clothing over 25 years ago now, and I was overwhelmed by it. I actually wept the first time I saw the scale of production, because what I immediately understood that could be described to me in no other way as a consumer at that point, rather than somebody who was proven in the industry, was that I understood there was such demand, it was beyond any scale I could recognize. And I think that would be 10 times the scale today, if not more. So whilst I will happily and always work towards legislation so that there is better information for consumers to feel informed and feel they're not being cheated out of any of those informed decisions, because it is absolutely true, consumers want to make purchases on good decisions. People don't go out of their way. People that wake up in the morning thinking, I wonder if I could just kill off another few rainforests today by buying a coat. That is not people's modus operandi, right? People want to make difference and make change. They get it. They understand it. And I think it's just on an offshoot here, really important with my TV work, that you recognise the importance of something like Attenborough versus other communication tools, because it is the visual of seeing it that is the impact. And I think that's so important, where actually a lot of environmental conversations are written and documented, and it's very difficult for the consumer to navigate that. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. Any research will come back to the fact that the consumer wants to do it. And the want is driven by a very complicated mix of emotions, including confidence. And the confidence or lack of it is driven by the materials we see every day and surrounded by in our worlds, be it an advert, be it a media post, be it a television programme, be it a premiere, or indeed be it our own social circle, perhaps not giving us the rally cry we need to feel confident. I think that's part of the issue. I wear clothes from 20 years ago, and I feel confident and comfortable doing that, because I have found a comfort zone in my own look, in my own self. But without that, I would still be relying on the triggers that are in there and part of the psyche. So this becomes then a bigger issue than environmental. This becomes bigger than any carbon recognition label we can put on clothing, or any clarity or transparency on supply chain, or the workers, or the ethics around it. This becomes about need versus want. And consumers wanted something to satisfy something in them that's emotional.
You've hit on a really interesting point there, I guess. Something that doesn't really get talked about in the sustainability space is how important it is to develop a sense of style that doesn't lead you down all these rabbit holes of different micro trends. And our colleague, Maddie Schultz, she'll be discussing algorithms and how that affects shopping later in the series. But I guess, Rachel, I know you've been doing a lot of research on what retailers and brands specifically can do to actually empower customers to make the decisions that they know are better and that, you know, actually enables them to make more responsible choices that make them feel good about the way that they shop, rather than knowing in the back of their head maybe that they're, you know, leading the world down to a terrible place through their shopping habits.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to explore both what some retailers and more sort of independent businesses are doing, and then also what some people are thinking could be done, like more sort of abstract ideas that could become reality but aren't necessarily being done yet. Selfridges is one sort of interesting example of a pretty established major retailer that has experimented with a few different ideas in its corner shop and then brought some of those into permanent offerings. So they have repair services in a bunch of different categories that they're trying to sort of put in front of the customer as opposed to offering it, but off in the side, or, you know, where you have to mail something in. And back to that point about convenience, where you're not going to do that, or, you know, a certain customer might do that, but for the most part, you're not going to reach the masses at scale with most of a wardrobe unless you really make it convenient and accessible. And then there's an interesting store/upcycling kind of repair shop in Los Angeles called Sway Sew Shop that does a bunch of interesting things. They do, you know, repairs and upcycling for clothes, and they work with garment workers who are sort of from the traditional manufacturing sector and trying to bring along people who have worked in traditional manufacturing and work them into the what could be the industry of the future, but then offering more creative ways to repurpose clothes, including offerings like their community dye bath, where they'll take drop-offs or mail-ins of clothes, and they'll do a mass batch of overdyeing so that you can, you know, refresh the look of a sweater or a pair of pants and you know, get your new color back and feel like you have a new garment.
I love that. Some really, really cool case studies in there. I guess if we're to jump back to the present, you know, from the future that we've been discussing, Kate, are there any demographics that are already inclined to take a slightly more values-driven approach to shopping and put in that extra effort that we're saying a lot of consumers don't have capacity to do right now?
Look, I think the thing that's really interesting when it comes to research, and I think you've probably both found this yourself, is that people will truth tell to a certain extent. No one wants to really go on file and say, I'm not bothered about the environment. I'm not bothered about the next generation. I don't care about this. I don't want to behave in this way. We can obviously try and extract from them where value becomes more important or perhaps efficiencies. But generally, I think what people say and what people do tend to be different things. And that's why I think my work is the importance for my work for retailers and manufacturers is understanding what's actually the truth line. Where is the clarity point? And generations, I think, have propensity to change their ways to get involved. Whilst we might see younger generations be more active or say they want to be more active, there's certainly signs that fast fashion continues to be overwhelmingly powerful in that space still. And yet in the re-commerce market with brands like Vinted, we've seen actually new customers come on board of a slightly older demographic, more millennials getting involved in Gen X. So I think what we've got to realise is that it's different research will give us different hope and different highlight, but this is a huge issue requiring huge change. And we need to make it social and fun. I was just thinking when Rachel was talking there about Los Angeles, I'm here in Los Angeles, and, you know, Crossroads Trading is a huge thrift network of stores. I think there's probably about 8 or 9 stores. The store environment is pulsy and vibey. The prices are fair. You can return items just as you could any other retail for exchange. The changing rooms and the fitting experience is positive, bright, well lit, etc. I think we've got to make sure that we have realistic alternatives. Alternatives that match up just as well as any other pristine shopping environment to make this feel like it is a permanent and a reasonable part of our day-to-day lives. And I think that will suit then multiple stakeholders, because this is all of our problem. This is all of our reality, and it's for all of us to solve. But it's for manufacturers and retailers to get engaged with that. I think to go back to the idea of retailers and manufacturers doing their bit, is a retailer ever going to go out and say, do you really need this? Is this really what you need to do right now? Or do you just need to use something? Go back home. Go back home, go through your wardrobe, find something there instead. You know, that's not going to be in the interest of profit holders, stakeholders, etc. But I think actually the culminative efforts of having realistic conversations, sitting down and finding out, Would consumers want those repurposed spaces? How would they want to use them? Or are you just always kind of hitting that same 12% of the population that just are inclined to feel more generous towards how they want to live their life and to better and more ethical purchase decisions? I kind of think that it's not about getting a small amount of people to do a lot. It's getting about a lot of people to make small change. And I think it's mass messaging that will be the tipping point to how we need to change our environmental stance in every single part of the mix.
You know, we've talked a bit throughout this conversation about some of the solutions that we expect to see in the future, namely sort of legislation and regulations. Kate, I know that's something that you're really passionate about, just mainly so that the onus isn't always on the consumer, and it kind of, you know, it levels the playing field so that brands can be better, really. But I guess, you know, can you tell me a little bit more about what sorts of regulations we can expect to come up in the future that brands should be aware of and how that will change the way that consumers shop?
Yeah, for me, I think the important thing to happen is more roundtables. I don't find it that easy for all elements of supply chain to be able to sit down sector across sector to be able to work together on solutions. I think that has to be very much driven by one manufacturer or one retailer, and that doesn't seem really to be the way forward. So I think there should be more capacity for conversation, for sharing best practice. We know that there's just been a legislation passed in France, for instance, in terms of labelling to understand the carbon offset. We know that there is going to be certainly more clarity in terms of the step process when it comes to environment being represented in the supply chain details on garments here in the UK. But it's going to take time. I mean, just to give a flip and an alternative, I'm involved in charities on social media and young people and protecting them there. You know, I've seen legislation take 5 years and then it starts to be implemented. And some of those businesses then say it could be another 5 years before implementation happens, at which case that legislation can be well out of date. That's a 10-year process. So I don't also hang my hat on anything I've seen coming through, whilst all positive change is welcome, that's going to be enough change or impactful enough to make the impact we need quickly enough. So I think for me, it's big, bold conversations, roundtables, with consumers also in the room, realistically talking about this. How do we reduce it down? And it might be one or two key points. I mean, we saw this with plastic bags in the supermarket. You put a levy on it or you put a fine on it, and a behaviour pretty much changes overnight. But as well as that element, which is a punishment, I guess, for consumers, it has to be the encouragement, giving them the confidence to walk the walk and talk the talk of someone who just doesn't feel driven to prove themselves or identify themselves only through new purchasing.
The plastic bag point is a really good example, I think, of both the power of legislation or a policy to disincentivize certain behavior, but how it also underscores the need for that behavior change in the psychology conversation. Because in some places where they've banned or put a tax on a plastic bag, it actually results in either more plastic being used because there's a requirement that something be reusable, a bag be reusable a certain number of times, but it's heavier plastic. And so you still use the plastic. So a good intention ends up having an unintended negative consequence, or just the obviously increased use of reusable bags that we all know has ramifications for the planet. I know there are some concerns about fashion as more regulations come either on the scene or into the pipeline. I know fashion brands are concerned about, like, how do we prepare when, especially if it's a sort of moving target. So I know in some senses there are concerns about it holding brands back because they don't know what they're preparing for exactly. But then on the flip side, there are concerns that fashion is working towards a compliance approach rather than fundamentally shifting how they approach sustainability and reducing their impacts.
We need macro change on a macro level, and a lot of that is attitudinal and emotional. And I think until we have realistic conversations about the emotional impact and how that changes us and how that can instantly evolve us from one decision to the other, we're not going to get to the heart of this issue. That's why I feel it's so important to get those roundtables and realistic conversations going.
That seems like a really great point to end on. So to summarize, we've learned that when it comes to shopping your values, consumers are really confused. More often than not, they want to shop ethically, but The desire for convenience and ease often also outweighs that. They're also sometimes disillusioned about how much impact they can really have. And for this reason, sustainability needs to be embedded into how brands operate through regulations so that ethical behavior is a given. Kate, it's been so great chatting with you.
Thanks, Kate, for being here. This has been such an interesting conversation.
Thanks for having me.
If you're enjoying what you're hearing on this podcast and want to gain access to the full Future of Shopping series, you might like to become a Vogue Business member. It's your ticket to a global perspective on fashion and beauty, delivering exclusive insights that will give you the edge in this competitive, dynamic industry. Visit voguebusiness.com today and use the code podcast20 to save 20% on the usual membership rate. That's voguebusiness.com, promo code PODCAST20. This has been Vogue Business's Future of Shopping podcast, presented by Worldpay. Thanks for listening.